Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, we hear a segment of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. We close the show, as always, with an American story. But first, we have a couple of reports about the start of the holiday season in the United States. The first comes from the White House. Here is Pete Musto.
The decorations are up, Melania Trump tweeted Monday morning. At White House is ready to celebrate. Wishing you a Merry Christmas and joyous holiday season. The theme for the White House decorations this year is time-honored traditions. Traditional Christmas wreaths are hanging outside every window of the White House, the official home of presidents in Washington, D.C. On top of each wreath is a bright red bow. Inside the building, visitors find a hallway lined with long, snow-white tree branches and shining lights. That hall leads to a tree with the Trump family's official Christmas ornament. The gold-colored metal decoration shows the presidential coat of arms surrounded by a wreath of holly. On Monday, First Lady Melania Trump welcomed students from a military base in Maryland to see the White House. They also got to make a few holiday decorations with her. "Are you the First Lady?" asked one little boy, who then moved in for a hug. Classmates quickly followed for hugs of their own. Ballet dancers performed at the White House as part of the official start of the holiday season. The First Lady wore a white dress and gold-toned shoes for the event. The dancers looked similar to those at the first themed Christmas at the White House in 1961. At that time, First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy had dancers performing to Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's famous Nutcracker Suite. "Surprise," Melania Trump said on Tuesday, as she later entered the Red Room, where children were working on Christmas decorations. "So you want to show me how to do it?" she asked after sitting at a table with four students. A boy showed her how to make them. Nearby was the Trump family Christmas card, along with cards from past presidents. "Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year," says the Trump's card, signed by the President, the First Lady, and Baron Trump, their 11-year-old son. That greeting is a change from the years when Barack Obama and his family were living in the White House. During his presidency, the cards offered more inclusive messages, such as season's greetings or wishes for happy holidays. Donald Trump has promised to put Christmas back at the center of the winter holidays. During his presidential campaign, he argued that saying happy holidays was a way of chipping away at Christianity. Among the Christmas decorations this year is a 5.5 by 1.8 meter balsam fir from Wisconsin. The tree occupies the center of the White House's Blue Room. Decorations representing every state and U.S. territory hang from its branches. A separate tree near the East Wing entrance honors military families who have lost loved ones. In the state dining room, a 160-kilogram gingerbread house offers a view of the White House from its south lawn. Candy-covered wreaths hang from every window and a U.S. flag flies from its sugary housetop. Jennifer Pickens, an expert on White House traditions, predicted that this year's window wreaths will become a tradition for future first ladies. More than 150 volunteers from 29 states spent 1,600 hours over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend getting the White House ready for the holidays. The White House said Melania Trump chose every detail of the design. The holiday celebrations began Monday with a party for the volunteers. Parties and other events, sometimes two a day, will continue for the next several weeks. I'm Pete Musto.
As soon as the Thanksgiving holiday is over, Santa Clauses start appearing everywhere, in shopping centers, supermarkets, and other places. It takes more than red clothing and a white beard to be a professional Santa. In fact, many aspiring Santas attend special classes. The C.W. Howard Santa School is in Midland, Michigan. It is the longest continuously running Santa Claus school in the world. This year, it is celebrating its 80th anniversary. VOA recently visited the school. More than 250 Santas have gathered at the school to prepare for their seasonal work. Charlie W. Howard was the Santa Claus in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade for 17 years. He started the school in 1937. Tom Valente is the school's current leader.
At that time, there was a great need for good Santa, better Santas. Santas didn't portray that image that we want. Santa Claus stands for all good things. And some of the gentlemen that were portraying that image weren't up to par then.
The three-day Santa workshop teaches people Santa sign language, facts about reindeer, and clothing and makeup style. The future Santas also learn about the newest wish list toys, gain interview experience for radio and television, and even get advice on how to do their business taxes. Robert Davis has played Santa for 30 years. He has attended the school several times.
I think no matter how good you are at whatever you choose to do, you can always be better. And it not only does the school teach you so much, but when you interact with 250 fellow people that love the same thing you do, you learn something new every year.
The Student Santa's headquarters is the Santa House. Tom Valente designed the house in 1986 to look like those made of gingerbread, a Christmas tradition. Conservative estimates suggest 15,000 students have graduated from the Santa School. They come from all over North America, Europe, Africa, and Australia to study. This year, the school welcomed Santas from all 50 states, as well as Canada, Denmark, New Zealand, and Norway. Fred Oster is the only Norwegian Santa at the school this year. He is known as Oslo Santa. It is his eighth time at the school.
I have been Santa this Christmas 65 years. I started to be a Santa when I was 12.
The Santas never claim to be the one and only real Santa. Instead, they describe themselves as the spirit of Christmas. At the school's opening night activity, Santa Walk, they tell visiting children they are the cousins of Santa. Robert Davis says they also never promise children anything. Instead, they say they will try their best.
Anywhere I go, I try to make my contact and exchange with that child the very best that it can be, because that could be that child's best 5 minutes of the year.
After all, as founder Charles W. Howard liked to say, he errs who thinks Santa enters through the chimney. Santa enters through the heart.
Yo, hip hop started out in the heart. Yo, not everybody trying to charge. Say what?
This is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler. In the mid-1990s, this voice arrived like a revelation to a whole generation coming of age as the millennium was about to turn.
Come on, baby, light my fire.
Come on.
Everything you drop is so tired.
Everything.
Music is supposed to inspire.
The voice, Lauryn Hills, was powerful, deeply soulful, with a perfect dose of grit. Ms. Hill fluidly switched between rapping and singing. She was stylish and beautiful, which never hurts. But more than that, she had beautiful things to say, and funny things, and profound political things. But of course, it's always hard to put a finger on exactly why a particular artist and a particular cultural moment collide in some kind of harmonic convergence to become a phenomenon. But Lauryn Hill was a phenomenon, and she was just 23.
In distant lands, made plans with the sheiks. Why you beef with freaks as my album sells peak, huh? All I wanted was to sell like 500 and be a ghetto superstar since my first album blunted. I used to work at Foot Locker, they fired me in front it. Or I quit it, now I spit it. However do you want it, now you get it. Right and rhyme, the range with the frames lightly tinted. And send it to your block and have my full name in it. And if your lines sound like mine, I'm taking a percentage. Unprecedented and still respected when it's vintage.
Then, just as quickly as she'd risen to international superstardom, Lauryn Hill backed out of the music business, out of public life, shut it down. She was like the J.D. Salinger of hip-hop. But at 25, soon after her retreat began, Ms. Hill was inducted into the Academy of Achievement and made a rare appearance to speak to a group of students at their annual summit. She was also interviewed for their archive by journalist Gail Eichenthal. In the past couple of years, Lauryn Hill has begun to resurface, some, and she's gone through big transformations. But in this episode of What It Takes, you'll hear Lauryn Hill as she was undergoing an earlier transformation. It was June of 2000, just 2 years after the release of her first and only solo studio album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. So sit back and enjoy the music and the words of a truly original artist at the crossroads.
I'll be very honest with you, as a musician today, I'm not in the studio right now, and everybody in my world thinks I'm crazy. What's going on? You need another album out. You know, the time is running out. You have a window, a certain window to make music. And for a little while, I listened to that. And I was like in the studio working real hard, trying to get it done. And you know, music was created. Definitely music that I think people will appreciate, but it wasn't my best. And it wasn't my best because there was no substance. And there was no substance because there was no experience. And the only reason why The Miseducation was the album it was because of a myriad of experiences that took place before the production part. before the creation.
I keep letting you back in. How can I explain myself?
My whole life at a certain point was studio, hotel, stage, hotel, stage, hotel, studio, stage, and I was expressing, I was expressing everything from my past. You know, you have to go back to the well in order to give someone something to drink. You know, you can't, I felt like a cistern dried up and like there was nothing more, you know, and it was so beautiful because normalcy. I returned to a normal situation with my children running around, screaming, and it was wonderful. And I walked down the street and I went grocery shopping and I loved it. Every minute of it I love. I find, you know, even when it's raining, I just go outside and I look outside and I'm just so blessed to see it and to experience it because for such a long time I was just indoors.
To hear the whole podcast on Lauryn Hill, go to the What It Takes section of our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now, here is Shep O'Neill reading part one of the American story, Benito Sereno, by Herman Melville.
Captain Benito Sereno hurried aboard his ship. It was ready to sail. A bright sun and a soft breeze promised good weather ahead. The ship's anchor was raised, and the San Dominique, old but still seaworthy, moved slowly out of the harbor of Valparaiso on the west coast of Chile. It was carrying valuable products and slaves up the Pacific coast to Callao, another Spanish colonial port near Lima, Peru. The slaves, both male and female, slept on deck. They were not chained because their owner, Don Alejandro, said they were peaceful. The San Dominique moved steadily forward under a clear sky. The weather showed no sign of change. Day after day, the soft breeze kept the ship on course toward Peru. Slave traffic between Spain's colonial ports in this year of 1799 had been steady, but there were few outbreaks of violence. What happened, therefore, on board the San Dominique could not have been expected. On the seventh day out, before daybreak, the slaves rose up in rebellion. They swept through the ship with handspikes and hatchets, moving with the fury of desperate men. The attack was a complete surprise. Few of the crew were awake. All hands, except the two officers on the watch, lay in a deep, untroubled sleep. The rebels sprang upon the two officers and left them half dead. Then, one by one, they killed 18 of the sleeping crew. They threw some overboard, alive. A few hid and escaped death. The rebels tied up 7 others, but left them alive to navigate the ship. As the day began to break, Captain Sereno came slowly, carefully, up the steps toward the chief rebel leader, Mbabo, and begged for mercy. He promised to follow Mbabo's commands if he would only put an end to the killings. But this had no effect. Mbabo had three men brought up on deck and tied. Then the three Spaniards were thrown overboard. Mbabo did this to show his power and authority, that he was in command. Mbabo, however, promised not to kill Captain Sereno. But everything he said carried a threat. He asked the captain if in these seas there were any Negro countries. None, Sereno answered. Then take us to Senegal or the neighboring island of St. Nicholas. Captain Sereno was shaken. That is impossible, he said. It would mean going around Cape Horn. And this ship is in no condition for such a voyage, and we do not have enough supplies or sails or water. Take us there anyway, Mbabo answered sharply, showing little interest in such details. If you refuse, we will kill every white man on board. Captain Sereno knew he had no choice. He told the rebel leader that the most serious problem in making such a long voyage was water. Mbabo said they should sail to the island of Santa Maria, near the southern end of Chile. He knew that no one lived on the island, but water and supplies could be found there. He forced Captain Sereno to keep away from any port. He threatened to kill him the moment he saw him start to move toward any city, town, or settlement on shore. Sereno had to agree to sail to the island of Santa Maria. He still hoped that he might meet along the way, or at the island itself, a ship that could help him. Perhaps, who knows, he might find a boat on the island and be able to escape to the nearby coast of Arauco. Hope was all he had left, and that was getting smaller each day. Captain Sereno steered south for Santa Maria. The voyage would take weeks. 8 days after the ship turned south, Mbabo told Captain Sereno that he was going to kill Don Alejandro, owner of the slaves on board. He said it had to be done. Otherwise, he and the other slaves could never be sure of their freedom. He refused to listen to the captain's appeals and ordered two men to pull Don Alejandro up from below and kill him on deck. It was done, as ordered. Three other Spaniards were brought up and thrown overboard. Mbabo warned Sereno and the other Spaniards that each one of them would go the same way if any of them gave the smallest cause for suspicion. Sereno decided to do everything possible to save the lives of those remaining. He agreed to carry the rebels safely to Senegal if they promised peace and no further bloodshed. And he signed a document that gave the rebels ownership of the ship and its cargo. Later, as they sailed down the long coast of Chile, the wind suddenly dropped. The ship drifted into a deep calm. For days it lay still in the water. The heat was fierce. the suffering intense. There was little water that made matters worse. Some of those on board were driven mad. A few died. The pressure and tension made many violent, and they killed a Spanish officer. After a time, a breeze came up and set the ship free again, and it continued south. The voyage seemed endless. The ship sailed for weeks with little water on board. It moved through days of good weather and periods of bad weather. There were times when it sailed under heavy skies, and times when the wind dropped and the ship lay becalmed in lifeless air. The crew seemed half dead. At last, one evening in the month of August, the San Dominique reached the lonely island of Santa Maria. It moved slowly toward one of the island's bays to drop anchor. Not far off lay an American ship, and the sight of the ship caught the rebels by surprise. The slaves became tense and fearful. They wanted to sail away quickly, but their leader, Babo, opposed such a move. Where could they go? Their water and food were low. He succeeded in bringing them under control and in quieting their fears. He told them they had nothing to fear, and they believed him. Then he ordered everyone to go to work, to clean the decks and put the ship in proper and good condition so that no visitor would suspect anything was wrong. Later, he spoke to Captain Sereno, warning him that he would kill him if he did not do as he was told. He explained in detail what Sereno was to do and say if any stranger came on board. He held a dagger in his hand, saying it would always be ready for any emergency. The American vessel was a large trade ship and seal hunter, commanded by Captain Amasa Delano. He had stopped at Santa Maria for water. On the American ship, shortly after sunrise, an officer woke Captain Delano and told him a strange sail was coming into the bay. The captain quickly got up, dressed, and went up on deck. Captain Delano raised his spyglass and looked closely at the strange ship coming slowly in. He was surprised that there was no flag. A ship usually showed its flag when entering a harbor where another ship lay at anchor. As the ship got closer, Captain Delano saw it was damaged. Many of its sails were ripped and torn. A mast was broken, and the deck was in disorder. Clearly, the ship was in trouble. The American captain decided to go to the strange vessel and offer help. He ordered his whaleboat put into the water and had his men bring up some supplies and put them in the boat. Then they set out toward the mystery ship. As they approached, Captain Delano was shocked at the poor condition of the ship. He wondered what could have happened and what he would find.
We'll be back next week with part two of Herman Melville's Benito Sereno. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.